The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. In this age of skepticism, cynicism, sarcasm, and fear, does it make any sense to talk about the Bible? Is the Bible up to date in this space age, or is it utterly out of date? Only a collection of ancient Hebrew fables and the ideas of reformers who were disgusted with the way the world was in their day. People talk about the Bible. Almost everyone has an idea about the Bible, an idea about God, or about their personal philosophy of life. There is even a new idea extant now that God is a sort of a transcendent nothingness that doesn't even have an IQ. People have all kinds of ideas about the Bible. But in this modern age of ours, would it look ridiculous to believe in the Bible, to take literally such statements as, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth"? Now, you know, there's one thing that almost all people, when they sit down to talk about religion, if they ever do, there's one thing they almost all have in common, and that is that at least the absolute belief in the Bible and the absolute belief that Bible statements are true is completely and utterly out of date. And if people do believe in religion at all, it's got to be some type of a religion of their own devising, or at least so it seems. It has to be a religion, let's put it this way, that at least is not based upon absolute and literal belief in the statements of the Bible. Now, that's not true of all religions. There are still some that say the Bible is the basis of their theology. But at least the idea that there is no God, that evolution is true, or it's even being called theistic evolution. And there is such a thing as atheistic, apparently, Christianity. There's the idea of the God is dead theory. There is the idea of, as some people put it, situation ethics. The idea that right is right depending upon how it appears. Idea about the Bible, as I've said in the World Tomorrow program, a rather glandular idea about the Bible, but they do not like to talk about it very much. But now what about it? Is the Bible up to date in this space age, and is there any way to prove it? Has our knowledge in this modern world of industry, of technology, and the advancement of scientific knowledge rendered the Old Testament of the Bible or belief in Christ absolutely out of date and irrelevant to our age? You know, there's a lot of discussion on the subject, but no one ever seems to come to actual grips with the finite, tangible issues in the evolutionary theories to really substantiate and to prove that there is a God. Now, you know, to be plausible and even remotely thinkable, evolution must answer in plain, understandable, and logical, and completely objective fashion thousands of exceedingly difficult questions, only a few of which I'm going to give you on this program. It's got to answer the questions about the missing link between man and the lower animals, which, of course, they've been desperately looking for from the time that the evolutionary theory began, but haven't found and never will find because there is no such link. I know that sounds like a fantastic statement, but I'm going to prove it. What about the intermediate species? Let's take a look at that just for a moment. If evolution is true, there would have to be a tremendous number, hundreds of thousands actually, even in between certain definite, clearly defined, and surviving species today. It would be sort of like taking a look at a projector, a motion picture projector. And here in one frame, you have a man who is in a certain definite pose in one corner of the room. And it's not even a real good analogy in one sense of the word, because let's say that about 10 or 12 feet of film later, this same actor is seated in a divan in a totally different corner of the room. But to get him from one corner of the room to the other, it took maybe a whole strip of 10 or more feet of film, so as to show him in every position that the camera clicked and stopped. And you know that motion pictures are actually still photos, but a whole strip of them that are run at various speeds through a motion picture projector. Now, as I said, it's not a good analogy because you're dealing with one room and one actor. But if evolution were true, you would have to have a whole series of thousands of intermediate species, which would represent not only the distinct species existing at each end of the extreme of the pole today, but all of those that existed in between. Now, let's put it this way. If evolution were true, Do you know there would have to be some worldwide organization which would be given support by all countries, some kind of a college or some central governing board which would decide who wears a tuxedo and who swings in trees? That there would be hundreds of thousands of individuals of these intermediate species where it would take a world court of law. And can you begin to imagine the riots and the problems and the race wars with a world like that? As to decide who's going to wear a tuxedo and who's going to go to college and who's going to swing in a tree. Now, let's come to grips with some actual questions to ask evolutionists and take a practical look at just a few of the questions that any good evolutionist must answer if evolution is true. Let's take the idea that all of these creatures gradually evolved and that the natural selection, which you hear a great deal about, survival of the fittest, another great cliche, actually did occur. Let's begin with a fish, a tropical fish called the archer fish, for an example. Now, this little tropical fish taxis in a position under an overhanging limb or a tree. And when an insect comes along, this archer fish sucks into his mouth water through his gills, aims his tongue, and then through a special groove in his mouth, jets a stream of water out above the water with such force and accuracy to pinpoint that insect, knocking it down into the water where the archer can make a meal of it. Now let's go back and think about the statements of evolution about the hundreds and hundreds of generations, thousands of generations, millions, actually aeons, because evolutionists can afford to be quite careless with time. They say, given enough time, this could occur. So let's be practical about it. Remember that this tiny, unintelligent archer fish has to take into account all the complex laws of the telescopic effect of water, the refraction of light as the water ripples and dances, the effect of gravity on the trajectory toward the insect. The mammoth physics problems involved are enough to send any human brain swimming. Many a young boy, or maybe his father, have stood over a stream and tried to shoot a fish, which incidentally is probably illegal in many states, and I've even read articles about bow hunters where it is legal to go out and try to shoot a big fish in shallow water. And they've learned real quickly that they have to shoot a considerable distance in front of the fish, and they have the advantage of man's brain, man's mind, man's equipment, and they're trying to shoot either an arrow or a bullet down into a fish through the water, while the archer fish is doing it in reverse. So the problems involved are considerable, but this ignorant fish never misses, or else if he does, he starves. Now, if any animal is specialized, the archer fish is. He's got a flattened head so that his head doesn't protrude out of the water when he gets up close to the surface. He has exceedingly large eyes and a shooting groove in his mouth to give him all the equipment he needs. Now, how did all this evolve? Here's the archer, and he's swimming around in an ancient primeval swamp. And suddenly, he's got to be able to survive. Now, can you believe evolution? Here's what would have happened. Thousands of generations of archer fish spurted, gurgled, spat, gulped, and finally, by chance, got a little water above the surface. Of course, these thousands of generations kept dying. Now, I know that sounds ridiculous, but this is what evolution would have to believe. Then, for a few thousand generations, the archer learned, all the while starving to death, that water refracted the light, and he had to aim a good bit below where he saw the object. And then, for a few more hundred generations of archer fish, they kept missing all the time, but that's all right. As they kept learning by missing and starving to death, finally came to their knowledge the laws of trajectory. And a few hundred more generations taught those archer fish that water magnified the prey. And so their calculations of distance and the effect of gravity on the water and everything came into play. A few more thousand generations passed until they got the accuracy down. The shots would scatter in every direction. The scared bug would fly away and never come back. But the archer was ready. Now finally, after all these billions of years, when no archer fish survived the first attempt, the archer fish was ready for the climactic moment. All these thousands of generations which had not survived were now ready for the climactic moment. And so, to borrow a statement from B.C., zot, a direct hit. Now the species can live in luxury and splendor, shooting down insects, winged moths, and various creatures from overhanging limbs and branches. Finally, they've made it. Now, does it make any sense? Because remember, the first archer fish had to succeed immediately. Now, there's another part of this, because you need to understand that it's easy for the average layman to come to grips with the biggest questions to the evolutionary theory. It really is simple. Here's another simple point. Did the archer fish need to evolve this flat head, bigger eyes, tremendous mechanism to shoot down insects out of the water, out of his natural habitat, from the air, like a World War II fighter plane? Well, apparently, in order to evolve such a fantastic mechanism, he had to need it. Now, before he had to absolutely require it, he had to have it for survival, which meant that he wasn't surviving in his natural habitat. He wasn't getting food under the water. But actually, he had to get food under the water to survive. Now, if he were surviving by getting food under the water, what self-respecting fish with a lake full of food would ever get it into his brain that he was going to devise mechanism over billions of aeons to get food outside of the water? And if he was a perfectly developed species getting all his food inside and underneath the water, why even begin to try to spurt water up above? Did it happen by accident? Why, in the memory of one archer fish, if he ever remotely could learn anything by accident, and any scientist and any ichthyologist will tell you, fish are not going to learn in that kind of a fashion. You've never seen a fish circus. You're not going to train fish that way, even though fish can be taught to do simple little jobs. He would not, in two or three generations, pass on to his little children, as they were hatched out of eggs, if you can call them children, the knowledge that if you spit water, a moth is going to fall. You know, evolution invented a pretty hardy species that can last those millions of years without a meal, didn't it? Do you think of all those billions of aeons of archer fish never eating a thing? You'll find that one succeeded in knocking down an insect. Isn't that fantastic? Now, let's go on, because there are a number of other problems attendant with the idea of evolution. What about a simple woodpecker? Now, here's a woodpecker who finally decides that he's got to peck beneath the bark of a tree. Let's pick an oak tree, because they do peck oak trees. I've seen oak trees that have had woodpecker holes in them. In order to survive. Now, remember, he's got to devote himself to working out some way to develop this mechanism if he's ever going to survive. And the woodpecker is the only creature you know of that spends nearly all of his waking hours banging his head against wood. Can you imagine the wrenching, violent, unbelievable headaches the first few millions of generations of woodpeckers had? Can you imagine the fractured beaks? Can you imagine the number of them that were hung up in a tree and couldn't get out? Can you imagine the number of broken necks, of mild or violent concussions? Can you imagine? And some of them are pecking away at this wood at more than 100 times a minute. Can you imagine anything more excruciating as banging your nose against the bark of an oak tree? And finally, because it was the way you decided you were going to get your food, to evolve a beak. Now, I know people are going to say, oh, come on. And they're going to laugh at this and say, well, you can't be serious about that kind of an analogy. Well, now, wait just a minute. Here's a woodpecker flying along through a forest full of trees. Does he require bugs from beneath the bark? Well, according to evolution, he would never have evolved all of this tremendous reflex mechanism of the muscles of his neck. He wouldn't have evolved a stronger beak, a longer beak, and a tongue that will go out about three times the length of his beak to even search through little channels that the insects are cutting behind the bark. He would not have evolved a tremendous extra strong bone structure through his entire head, powerful neck muscles, unusually thick skull, unless he had to survive. But the point is, if he's flying along through a primeval forest, and he's eating bugs out on the ends of the limbs, and he's picking them off the lichens and the moss below, whatever gave the woodpecker the idea there was an insect underneath the bark? He couldn't see him. He doesn't have X-ray vision. And he doesn't need the bug. We know that because there are bugs on the forest floor. You can go look at them yourself. They're still there today. Why doesn't the woodpecker pick them up? Well, you know, evolution ought to answer some of these simple questions if they have all the rest of the answers, don't you think? Now, there's a tremendous shock absorber in a woodpecker's mechanism, a spongy, elastic tissue that cushions the blow. And that's how the woodpecker can remain level-headed in all of his endeavors. Now, his tongue is even more amazing. In some cases, a woodpecker's tongue is four times the length of his beak. A woodpecker will jam his beak in the tree, and once he's found a little hollow cavern where some of these little grubs are existing, or little ants or something running around, he'll snake his long tongue, which is sticky, inside that tree and let it lie there. Some of these insects look at it, think it's a worm, start to attack it, and he drags them into his mouth. How about that for evolution? Of course, the first few millions of years, the first woodpecker that tried it, let's just imagine the very first woodpecker. Now, here's the very first scientific experiment on the part of a woodpecker. When that first naive, unsuspecting woodpecker who didn't have brains enough to know he should have attacked a corkwood or a balsam wood tree hit the first oakwood tree, he probably had a brain concussion. He probably had a violent headache. He found the wood was really hard. Now, any sensible woodpecker would have given that up after he broke half his beak off and gone back to picking him up around the forest floor like he had been able to do if he existed as a complete and a separate species in the first place. But, you know, you would have seen a forest floor littered with dead, staggering, half-insane woodpeckers. You would have had a real problem. All the woodpeckers with violent, wrenching, jarring headaches. Any logic to that idea? Any logic to the idea that if there was a definite kind of a bird that we know today as a woodpecker, and isn't that a sophisticated technical term, woodpecker? It means that he pecks wood. Some of them are red-headed woodpeckers. Now, there's nothing scientific about that. It's just that they happen to have a red head, and they peck wood. All right. Here they were, as evolution would have you believe, a completely, fully developed, absolutely independent species getting their food by whatever method at that time, prior to the time the first naive, unsuspecting woodpecker, without a headache, attacked the first tree. But somehow, there had to be a law of survival of the fittest, or a law of natural selection, which they talk about all the time, which demanded these woodpeckers get grubs out from underneath bark and do it quick or starve to death. Now, if they didn't need to do it, then there was plenty of food available elsewhere, and there's no need for them to go pecking on wood. The need had to be there first, before they began to peck on the wood. Does it make sense? Well, you know, I mean, as I've said, people never come to grips with evolution. They sit around, they think about it, they talk about comparative anatomy, and they talk about all of these relationships between such insects and birds and all the rest of it. And they think about the evolutionary tree, and you think in the glitter and the glamour of some of the big, thick books you've seen, and all of the beautiful statements in newspapers by science editors about how old man is, or you hear some statement about Zinjanthropus africanus, and it all seems to be overwhelming. All of the statements of university professors and doctors of paleontology and professors that are supposed to be really educated and know exactly what they're talking about. But when you come to grips with just simple, little, common, everyday layman's questions about evolution, it takes on a completely different perspective. Now, to go down the line with some of these, what about specializations of animals that are equipped with special mechanisms? Take the anteater. He's got a cylindrical tongue, a long fluted snout for digging down in holes in the earth, and digging claws, and he had to have them if he wanted to subsist on ants. Now, would anybody figure a more horrible way to subsist? All those difficult-to-be-reached little creatures running around in scattered, frantic profusion, and there are many, many species of ants, of course, and yet here's an animal designed and specially fitted for one purpose only, to invade anthills, and everything he owns is fashioned for ant hunting and ant hunting alone. How did they survive while they were evolving all this specialized equipment? Now, there are only four anteater species, each one living on a separate continent today. How did all of that come about? How did it happen? Evolution doesn't have a satisfactory answer. You can take a little creature called a basilisk. Now, the reason he's called that is because he's a water runner, and that's what it means. He's a small lizard, and he runs on the surface of the water with his little sort of a cup-like feet, and they have little air cushions underneath him, and his long tail is used as a balancing organ, thrust up in the air, broad feet distributing his almost negligible weight evenly, and if he slows down, he begins to sink. Now, he doesn't need to run in the water except that his livelihood is on the surface of the water where no other lizard dares to tread. And since no other lizard can compete with him out there for food supply. But the point is, the first basilisk who wanted to run out on the surface of the water probably had the same experience Peter is said to have had in the New Testament of the Bible. He didn't know he had to run at that speed, so he ran out, took a look around, and sank and drowned. And, of course, they kept drowning. And the first few centuries, millions upon millions of them drowned until none of them survived. And, of course, then when there weren't any basilisks, finally the basilisks evolved the mechanism necessary, the sense, the accuracy, the speed, and all of this that they needed to understand to survive by walking around on the surface of the water. It's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? Because they had to have perfection immediately. The very first trip had to be the best one, had to be exactly right. Now, when I used to stand along and fish on some of the streams in Oregon, I saw a strange-looking bird. And still, it's one of the real oddities to evolutionists and to ornithologists and people who enjoy nature studies. It's called, some people call it the Dipper, because it sits on a rock beside the water and it bobs up and down with a funny sort of an appearance, but it's also called the water ouzel. Now, I've watched these birds because they fly underwater. I mean it, they actually use their wings and flutter their wings over which the water is flowing in a surging, heavy flow of water in a mountain stream. And I mean to tell you, the Blue River or the Mackenzie River along in Oregon have an awful lot of water running down through them, and I've seen water ouzels leave a rock and walking along upstream, picking some of the various types of bottom life, the various types of nymphs and so on that live there. That's where they get their food. They come back up, immediately all the water runs off of them, and they have no competitors whatsoever. Now, of course, here are these wings designed so thickly and so tightly constructed, the body doesn't even get wet. Amazing birds, they've been seen flying through holes in the ice and emerging thereafter with no effects whatsoever in the same hole. But they're walking around pecking underneath the water, and then they come back up. Now, why don't other birds have this ability? And what about the first few thousand decades, generations, centuries? What about the first few aeons or millions of years when the first ouzel that fell in a raging stream drowned? The first one that didn't manage to evolve those thickly constructed feathers with the oil on them to make the water fall off of them? And if the water ouzel was perfectly happy to survive on the land and walk around and pick on the edge of the stream, whatever put it in this creature's head that there's food on the bottom of that rushing, raging, brawling torrent of a river? And how would the first timid little ouzel have stuck one claw in to kind of feel his way along and then got tumbled downstream and drowned? It had to be, the first trip was a perfect one. And he only did it because he needed to, evolution says? No, that's idiocy. That does not make sense. The first water ouzel had to make a successful trip. But evolution says the only reason he made a successful trip was because he had to. But if he had to, he was going to starve where he was. And if he did, the first trip had to be right. So what you actually have is, evolution is trying to tell you that every one of these incredible abilities of some of these creatures to survive had to be absolutely, completely, and totally developed by the time of their first attempt to gain food or to survive the attacks of predators or to do all the things that some of them do, even conduct major surgery on themselves automatically, as I'm going to show you, and to do it perfectly the first time. Now take, for example, a couple of creatures which perform surgery on themselves. There's the fence lizard. Here comes a badger or some other predator, maybe a hawk or something, sees him sitting on a fence. He's called a fence lizard only because he's a lizard, and once in a while people saw him on a fence. Before there were fences, he might have been called a rock lizard. Anyhow, he's a lizard. And what he does, he immediately detaches his tail and runs off. The tail is wiggling. The badger grabs the tail, and he's eating this wiggling tail while the new tail begins to grow as the lizard is in his den safely. Now, of course, the first few generations, the lizards weren't able to get that tail detached by automatic surgery, a sort of a psychosomatic release of their tail. And so they got eaten, they didn't survive, they didn't get away in time, and of course they never survived, so there aren't any today. Now, that doesn't make sense, that's idiocy too. But meanwhile, today, the lizard is alive and has a healthy new tail, push-button surgery, but it had to occur immediately. Everywhere you look in nature, whether camouflage, migration, the instinct of animals, their ability to survive, the fantastic colors, the intricacy, the interdependability, the design, the balance in nature, every last bit of it had to be perfect immediately, or else it never could have been in the first place. And this is a fact. You don't find half-disjointed tails. You don't find archer fish unsuccessful, starving to death. You do not find creatures only partially developed today. And you do find, however, the missing intermediate species, multiple billions of species in every last phase of insect, animal, life, and even, for that matter, the link between humans and other animals. And there is no such link. But there is a missing link, all right. That's the link between man and his creator, his God. And it's about time you began to write for these booklets and articles I've been announcing and prove to yourself there is such a link. Why don't you write for these booklets, Does God Exist, and the Proof of the Bible, and see some of these points proved to yourself once and for all. And our booklet on Does God Exist, the one on the proof of the Bible, and the companion article which will come along automatically, Seven Proofs God Exists, deals with just such things as I've been mentioning here and more. Some of the basic proofs that there is a God. And it's absolutely free of charge. There is no price. And now let me take time to tell you again about the Ambassador College Bible Correspondence Course. When you hear me telling you about the Bible, about Christ, about the fact that the gospel is relevant and up to date today, do you begin to wonder? Most people do. They say, look, you can't tell me the Bible has anything remotely to do with our way of life in this modern nuclear age. The world is filled with an accent on science. Every single newspaper, you read of announcements about recent space shots, or somebody uncovers another bone, or somebody has some chemical experiment by which he hopes to uncover a certain secret in life. Well, are those things true? Did you and I evolve? Did our ancestors used to grunt and snort and sort of drag their knuckles on the back of the ground? Did they anciently come out of a swamp and climb trees? Where did we come from? Can you prove it? Can you demonstrate it? I've announced constantly these booklets, Does God Exist, and the Proof of the Bible. Well, now, as a direct relationship to that, the Ambassador College Bible Correspondence Course talks about why bother with a study of the Bible in the space age? Why is the Bible ignored and rejected and impugned and ridiculed by people today? Is it worthy of that ridicule? Can you prove it? What is the Bible? Most people couldn't tell you much about it. They've got a very definite opinion about it, but they couldn't tell you much about it. And isn't that pretty well true of opinionated people? Now, you know, true freedom is of fantastic worth. And true freedom ought to also envision intellectual freedom. The freedom to pursue, to track down, to uncover knowledge, factual research, historical, practical proof in certain matters of which you're in question. Now, this beginning number will show you why a study of the Bible is important in the first place. It answers the question, why should anyone want to study the Bible? What is the Bible? How do you study it? Where do you start? How do you begin to understand it? If you can, most people think you can't. I've heard all my life people tell me you can prove anything by the Bible. Oh, you can't prove any such thing. Now, you can take words out of the Bible, twist them around, get them out of context, turn them backwards and upside down, and then claim to prove it. But the way the Bible is written, you can't prove anything but the truth. You can prove the truth of God, but you can't prove anything else. Well, now, when you read a word, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, can you believe it? Now, you're the product of a modern school system. You've gone through it just like I have. You read about the caveman, about the Neanderthal man, about the Cro-Magnon man, and if you were in school when I was, you even read about the Piltdown man, which, of course, has since been expunged from all textbooks, and you'll have to look quickly if you can find any reference to him anymore. That was, as I think you may recall, a hoax. Makes you wonder about some of the rest of it. But why don't you write for this first number? There's no obligation. There is no insert that tells you to write for something. Nobody's going to come calling on you trying to sell you a bunch of books. It's absolutely free of charge. The only book you'll need to buy is something you ought to have anyhow. If you don't have your own Bible, then you may need to go out and get one. And that's up to you to find wherever you live, whether you live in Johannesburg or up in Manchester. So write for this. It's absolutely free. You're going to be inspired when you see it. You'll be glad you wrote for it. It's an 8.5 by 11 notebook size. So you can put it in a loose-leaf notebook, and there is no obligation and no follow-up. If you get the first one and decide you don't want to continue, that's up to you. But write for it. It's absolutely free and without tuition, the Ambassador College Bible Correspondence Course. Remember the other booklets I've announced. They're free. There is no follow-up and no request for money. Send your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Request the Ambassador College Bible Correspondence Course by sending your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. The address again in just a moment. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.